WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Tom Friedman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. He just returned from a trip to Israel, Jordan, and Syria. We asked him to talk with us about the war between Israel and Hezbollah and where Syria fits in. Yesterday, the Israeli Security Cabinet agreed to expand the ground war, and the Syrian government put its military on high alert. Tom Friedman has been writing about the Middle East since 1979, when he started covering Beirut for UPI. In 1982, he became the New York Times correspondent in Lebanon. 2 years later, he started covering Israel for the Times. His best-selling 1989 book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, won a National Book Award. Friedman's latest book, the bestseller The World is Flat, is about the global economy. Tom Friedman, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the places you went on your Middle East trip was to Syria. Why did you want to go there?
Well, it struck me, Terry, that Syria is really at the center of so much of what's going on right now. First of all, Syria is the land bridge that connects Hezbollah in Lebanon with its primary backer, Iran. And Iran could not provide Hezbollah with the rockets it has, except by going through Syria. So that's the first reason I went there. Secondly, it's long been known that the Iranian embassy in Damascus has been the primary contact point for Hezbollah and the Iranians. And it seemed to me that if one were to step back and say, what would Henry Kissinger do right now? That is, what is the game-changing move that could really shake up this chessboard, and in a way that would be positive for American interests? If you think about where Syria is in this whole equation, the bridge between Iran and Hezbollah, the back room for Hamas in Gaza, and also the back room for the insurgents in Iraq, that the big game-changing move would be if you could somehow move Syria from an alliance headed by Iran back into its really traditional home in many ways, the Sunni Arab world, with Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, countries much more pro the United States. That, if we could somehow do that, that's what would really change this whole equation. And really, as soon as the fighting broke out, I decided that's what I got to do. I got to get on a plane and go to Damascus and try to assess whether that kind of move is at all possible, because only that kind of move, I think, could really change the whole chessboard.
So who did you talk to try to assess that?
I actually interviewed the Syrian foreign minister and another cabinet minister and Syrian economist and lots of diplomats when I was there and local Syrian journalists. And I came away feeling that it's a real long shot. Syria and the United States are deeply alienated today. We have withdrawn our ambassador from Damascus, Margaret Scobie. She's been gone for months now. Our chargé d'affaires there, is about to leave, a very able diplomat. He's about to be replaced by someone new. They're only allowed our diplomats there to meet with the chief of protocol at the Syrian foreign ministry, and his job is to ask you how you like your Turkish coffee. So we have really no dialogue with Syria. And the Syrians know that they're basically alone, but that they've got Iran at their back. Iran, which has billions of dollars in oil money today and lots of weapons, developing a nuclear capability. And so it would be very hard, but I also could hear in between the lines that it might not be impossible. It might not be impossible for several reasons, Terry. Number one, because Syria is a Sunni Muslim country. Iran is a Shiite Muslim country, led by a religious hierarchy. Syria is a very secular country. They're not natural allies. I don't think a lot of Syrians are comfortable in this relationship. And the best evidence of that, diplomats pointed out to me, is how many times the Iranians keep sending senior delegations to Damascus just to make sure everything's okay. So I think the Iranians are quite insecure about this relationship, which has no real historical foundation, no geographical foundation. It's a really artificial creation. I don't think it's impossible. The price for the Syrians would be very high. It would be a resumption of negotiations over the Golan Heights with Israel and probably some kind of tacit understanding about their, quote-unquote, legitimate security interests in Lebanon. But I think it's a dialogue at least worth having.
So if Syria separated from Iran and if Syria was invited to peace talks or ceasefire talks, what role do you think Syria could play?
Well, the most important role they could play would be to endorse an international force in South Lebanon, which would send a signal to countries wanting to contribute forces to such a peacekeeping operation, but a robust peacekeeping operation, not blue helmets, you know, with a bunch of Norwegians, Swedes, and Ghanaians, but, you know, a real NATO-like or Bosnia-like force. If the Syrians gave their green light to that, then I think countries would contribute. If they didn't, I think a lot of countries will not contribute. I don't think any countries will contribute.
During the years that Syria occupied Lebanon, and they pulled out their troops only last year, what did they get out of being there?
Oh, the Syrians milked Lebanon dry. Syrian officers and intelligence people basically, you know, pulled every important string in Lebanon. You couldn't really get any senior government position without their tacit approval. They were renowned for being involved in, you know, a myriad smuggling scams. And most of all, they basically erased the border between Syria and Lebanon in terms of Syrian workers. So you had the Lebanese economy basically absorbing up to, I think, as many as 1 million Syrian workers who couldn't find jobs in Syria. That was a big deal.
So they got money out of it?
They sucked Lebanon dry financially. They got money. They got jobs. And they got a broader sort of front with Israel to protect their flank. You know, Syria was basically in the Bekaa Valley, its soft underbelly, so Israel couldn't do a left hook into Damascus.
Now, you know, I was reading your book From Beirut to Jerusalem again over the weekend.
Bless your heart.
And you have a whole chapter devoted to Hama, which was a city in Syria in which there was an incredible massacre. Why don't you just explain what happened there?
Well, in 1982, Syria faced its own Islamist uprising. And at that time, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president, Bashar al-Assad, was in power. And for years, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood was becoming stronger and stronger in Syria in opposition to the ruling Assad family, which comes from a sect of a sect. It's sort of a offshoot of Shiism, which is known as Alawite Islam. And the Alawis are about 10-11% of the population of Syria. Most of the rest are Sunni Muslims. And so you have this kind of minority ruling over this Sunni majority. And the Sunni majority at the religious end, there was this Islamic fundamentalist movement that basically was trying to topple the regime. The movement was headquartered, had its greatest strength in Hama. And in Hama, it basically made a bid to take over the town and use it as a foundation to foment a rebellion against the Assad government. And they had been involved in running clashes, the government and these Muslim brother groups, for months. But basically what happened in, I believe, February of 1982, Hafez al-Assad decided he was going to finish this problem once and for all. And he basically pummeled Hama, leveling whole neighborhoods. You've seen the pictures of Qana, the buildings that were brought down by Israel in South Lebanon. That was basically what whole neighborhoods of Hama looked like after days of pummeling by the Syrian army, artillery, and I believe probably air force as well. And one should know exactly what one is dealing with when you're dealing with Damascus. As I said in my column, this is a brutal, ruthless regime. I have no illusions about it. They are responsible, probably indirectly, for what happened to the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Marines in Beirut. And yet we dealt with them afterwards. We dealt with them in Gulf War I. We dealt with them on the Madrid Peace Conference. You know, you gotta, in this neighborhood, you just have so many bad actors, and you really have to make a choice. Are you going to stand on principle and say, you know, we're not going to deal with you because you're really bad? That's cool. That's a policy. If we're going to go to war with Syria to make them pay for all the bad things their regime has done, I totally get that. But if you're not going to go to war, but you really need them, and you're just going to adopt this kind of aggressive verbal stance and some economic sanctions, then you kind of have the worst of all worlds, because basically you then have a hostile Syria, but it's not afraid of you, and therefore you have no real leverage. And that seems to me to be the penumbra that we're in right now vis-a-vis Syria, and I don't see it serving anyone right now.
I just want to say something else about, this is President Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father. A month after the massacres in Hama, he said, "Nothing is more dangerous to Islam than distorting its meanings and concepts while you are posing as a Muslim. This is what the criminal brothers are doing, the Muslim Brotherhood. They are killing in the name of Islam. They are butchering children, women, and old people in the name of Islam." But would President Assad today, the son of that President Assad, consider criticizing Hezbollah for being dangerous to Islam because it was distorting its meanings and concepts and killing
people? No, this is
people?
All about staying in power. And if Hezbollah is ready to act as Syria's cat's paw in Lebanon, then, wow, we're all for Hezbollah, and we don't really care. They'll just make sure that Hezbollah can never operate in Syria. The thing about Hafez Assad, the current president's father, is that he was the most dangerous kind of extremist. He was an extremist who knew when to stop. You see, what distinguished him from Saddam Hussein, who in the end proved to be a moron, was that he was an extremist who didn't know when to stop. He was always overplaying his hand. And, of course, the great thing about extremists is that they don't know when to stop, and they usually overplay their hand and undo themselves, as Saddam did. Hafez Assad was really dangerous. He was an extremist who knew when to stop. He knew when to level Hama and then when to rebuild it with lovely new government housing. He knew when to crush the Muslim Brothers and then build a new mosque around the corner. You know, he had a wonderful, wonderful, in inverted commas, sense of balance and survival. He was really the preeminent, you know, Middle East Machiavellian player. I don't think his son has anywhere near the sophistication of the father. But like I keep saying, it's worth testing, only because I don't know how the alternative of trying to ignore them is going to work.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. After the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah, Friedman traveled to Israel, Syria, and Jordan. You think that Hezbollah miscalculated? You think Israel miscalculated too?
Too soon to tell. Too soon to tell. Certainly Israel miscalculated, if you think this is about a PR war, and Israel has, by tragically, you know, hitting a building that kills 56 Lebanese civilians in one day, and this is a tragedy, has gotten a huge global black eye on it. But, you know, wars are fought for political ends, Terry, and we'll see what the political end is here. You know, Nasrallah says, we've won already. We've stopped the Israeli army. And, you know, we fought them to a standstill. We're the pride of the Arab world. And, you know, you just hear that stuff and you want to weep. You want to weep because you want to say, don't you see? Israel's making microchips and you're making potato chips and you won? Israel has the Technion and you've got Hezbollah high and you won? Israel has more companies on the NASDAQ than any country in the world outside the United States other than Canada, and you can't make a light bulb and you won? What a terrible thing to say. You know, I don't care at the end of the day, what Hezbollah says about Israel, they can hate the Israelis and the Jews all they want. But you know what really disgusts me and makes me just enormously angry? It's not what they do to the Israelis. It's what they do to their own people. The future they have deprived their own children of. The fact that they hate Israel more than they love their own kids. That is such a travesty.
Do you feel agonized now over the civilian casualties in Lebanon from the Israeli air campaign?
Oh, of course. I mean, and this isn't some cheap, I feel agonized about all civilians. I lived in Beirut for 5 years. And I was so excited to go back to Beirut. I think it was 1999. I hadn't been back basically since 1982. And see the incredible amount of rebuilding that had happened. Some of it paid for out of the pocket, incidentally, of Rafik Hariri. I have a lot of friends there. Lebanon's where I started my career. My wife and I started our marriage there. It breaks my heart to see this. And the tragedy of the Arab world today, which is so well documented in the Arab Human Development Reports, is that there are so many young people there who aspire to something different, okay? But the politics is really perverse. And when someone like Nasrallah, who is just another false messiah, just in the line of Nasser, another guy who will stand on the ruins and say, it isn't whether you win or lose, it's just whether you fight the Jews. Another guy who will stand on the ruins and say, look what we won. You just know what a long-term travesty this is. And let me tell you something from my perspective, Terry, that I would just add. You know, there's already all this commentary, Nasrallah won, Nasrallah won, Nasrallah won. Yeah, you know, in the Middle East, Terry, there's the morning after, and there's the morning after the morning after. I have no doubt if there's a ceasefire here, the morning after, Nasrallah will stand on the ruins and say, I won. We fought the Jews to a standstill. Yes, 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 yes. Applaud, 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 applaud. But the morning after, when people come home, they look at their homes that are flattened, their factories that are flattened, their futures that are flattened, there will be a reckoning. I reckon there will be a reckoning. The laws of gravity even apply to Hezbollah.
It seemed like Mahmoud Abbas, who is the head of the Palestinian Authority, was on the verge of getting some agreement on using a peace plan that was drawn up by Palestinian prisoners who are still very, very powerful politically, and using that as a template to start negotiations again. He was on the verge of moving forward with that when Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier. Do you think that timing was intentional?
It was intentional, Terry, but here's the real story. There's Hamas, and then there's Hamas's military wing. And the military wing takes direct orders from the Hamas commanders in Damascus, not from Haniya, the Hamas prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. And I have been told while I was in Israel that what was going on was that basically the Hamas political authority was looking to reach a power-sharing agreement with Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah people. They were on the verge of that when the Hamas military wing, under orders from the leadership in Damascus, abducted this Israeli soldier to blow it all up. And so, that's part of the perverseness of this region.
So, in other words, Syria didn't want this agreement to go forward.
Syria didn't want this agreement to go forward, and the Hamas external leadership didn't want this agreement to go forward because it would have meant the Hamas leadership in Gaza then would have had greatly enhanced authority. So this was also an intra-Hamas struggle, because if Hamas inside Gaza and the West Bank were able to participate in the government in an effective way, open peace talks with Israel, the authority of Hamas outside would have been greatly diminished and become increasingly irrelevant.
And in that sense, they succeeded. I mean, they succeeded in stopping any forward movement and pushing things very backwards.
Bad guys, they win so often in that part of the world. It's been such a long time, Terry, since the good guys and good gals won.
Now, you've written that the world hates President Bush more than any U.S. president in your lifetime. What does that mean for America right now?
What it means is something really sad, which is that, you know, a lot of bad things happen in the world without us. But there aren't a lot of good things. I mean, big good things like a Kyoto, like a Gulf War I alliance against a mad dictator who invades Kuwait. There aren't a lot of big good things in the world that happen without us. And there are so many big good things now that we need to have happen, Terry, whether it is on climate change or on disease or on world trade talks or on trying to somehow shore up the only elected democracy in the Arab world, albeit flawed, in Iraq. There's so many big good things that we need to have happen, and we just are too radioactive. This administration has enormous moral clarity, and it has no moral authority. It has no moral authority because it walked away from Kyoto, an issue that so many people around the world feel is important. It has no moral authority because it perpetrated Abu Ghraib, but never really prosecuted anyone higher than the local grunts who did it. It has no moral authority because it came to Iraq in the name of democracy and has produced a complete disaster, you know, in many ways. And because of that, we can't do a lot of the big, good work that needs to be done right now. And that is really bad because these people are going to be here for 2.5 more years. And they are so radioactive, they glow in the dark.
Well, Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Tom Friedman is a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.